It's a privilege for me to be here this morning and to share with you this time of rest and refreshing that we have in the presence of the Lord. And it's such a pleasure to share this blessing with sisters. And this is just a little taste of what heaven is going to be like when we really get over there and we have nothing between our souls and the Savior and nothing between us and each other. It's going to be pure joy and peace and blessing. This morning, I'm just going to give you my testimony. It's a bit long, so if you have to leave, just go. And the longer I live, the longer the story gets. But we were in prison camp 3 times as long as Corrie ten Boom, and she wrote a book about it. And I had a mongoloid son, and he lived 3 times as long as Dale Evan Rogers, and she wrote a book about it. And I'm a preacher's widow like Catherine Marshall, and she wrote a book, and I'm trying to tell it to you in half an hour. So if I speak fast, that's the reason, because I feel a sense of urgency, because some of you I know have to go places today. They are not duplicates, your life and mine. God does not utilize the same design for both. You shall have some joys I'll never know. Some griefs I shall not have to undergo. Some hills of hope are not for me to climb. Your disappointment roads may not cross mine. Divergently we prove God's plan decree. Your life is best for you, and mine is best for me, because of the plan that he has. I was saved when I was 13 years old. I had heard about the Lord, and I had been counting on him, actually, all my life, because I had been raised for the first few years of my life in my grandmother's home. Well, actually, my mother died when I was 2 3/4 years old, leaving 3 of us little tiny kids. And then my brother lived with one grandmother, my sister and I with another grandmother, until my father remarried when I was 5 years old. And eventually I became the oldest of 11 children. So we had a big family. But when I was 13 years old, our family was not attending church, but some neighbors went around the neighborhood canvassing for some special meetings that were being held in Tacoma. My sister and I promised that we would go with the neighbors, and this was going to be a big adventure. But during the middle of the week, I had an opportunity to have another adventure that I thought was more important. I had an opportunity to have my first date, 13 years old. Can't believe it now, but I was just beginning to realize that there were boys in the world that were different than my brothers. And this one young man in particular, and he invited me to go with his youth group, I suppose now it was, to a wiener roast. So I ran home to tell my father that I had an opportunity to have a date. And he says, "What night of the week is that?" And I told him, he says, "That's the night you promised to go with the neighbors." "I know, Daddy, I know, but this is the most important thing in my life." "No," he said, "you promised to go." "But Daddy, I can tell the neighbors I can't go. This is important, much more important than going with the neighbors." And my father was firm, and I'm glad that he was, because 13-year-olds don't know what they need nor want. Only I thought I wanted and I needed this, but I didn't. But that night I went with the neighbors, and at the altar call I went forward, accepted the Lord as Lord and Master of my life, and that was the end of that romance. Not because he wasn't a nice boy, but because I had a new turn of direction. I had one consuming desire now, and that was to find out what it was that God had for my life. Because I had now become the child of the Heavenly Father, and he must have a plan, I figured, and I wanted to know what it was. So I dedicated myself to this. The boys then began to tease me. My name was Cole. And so they started calling me anthracite, you know, bituminous is soft coal and anthracite's hard coal. And I wouldn't go with the fellows. And so they started teasing me and calling me anthracite. Well, that was all right, because I was still consumed with this desire to find out what it was that God wanted with my life. Through high school, I lived with a relative for 1.5 years and then worked my way through the rest of high school as a maid in a home, not knowing what it was yet. But I did want to help people, so I thought maybe I should be a nurse, maybe I should be a school teacher. I didn't know for sure, but times were really hard. That was during the Great Depression, and those of you who are older can remember that. So there was no chance that I could ever go to college. That was really out of the picture. But I was working for a family, the Schoenfeld family in Tacoma, actually. And they said that if I'd stay with them till their baby was born, which was on the way, if I'd stay with them 2 more years, they would put me through nursing school. Now that was a great and gracious gift, but I still wasn't sure what it was that God wanted me to do. Well, I went to camp meeting on a day off, and there I discovered a college booth for Bible school. I went by, and when no one was looking, because I was quite shy, I went up and took a piece of this free literature, and then I felt really that that's what I should do. I should go to Bible school, so I came to Seattle. During my first year at school, we had to join prayer bands, each student, home missions, Africa, Orient, or whatever. And after much prayer, I decided it should be the Oriental band for me. And then after a siege of pneumonia, when they really didn't think I was going to live at all, but the Lord saw fit to let me live, I felt a call to China. Now it's really hard to describe to somebody how you feel a call. But the principal of school that afternoon had been talking to us, and under a real special anointing, he said, there are students here this afternoon that God wants to call into his service, students who feel that they have no talents at all, but God wants to take them and use them, and then he'll get all the glory for it. And in the prayer band that afternoon, I said, Lord, I fit into that category. And if you can use me, here is my life. I'll be glad to give it to you. And it seemed, I don't know what happened, but it seemed like a vision that I was with a Chinese lady and praying for her. And then gradually the Lord just seemed to open it up that that really was the direction. Well, by the end of my freshman year, I had all the fellows in school figured out. There was number one. You know, he was the top one. He was president of our class, and he was a neat fella. Tall and blonde, Norwegian, blue eyes, pimples on his neck, and he had a terrific sense of humor. Just a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. And then what appealed to me most was his dedication to God. He was determined that whatever it was that God wanted in his life, that was what he wanted, even if it cost him trouble or hardship. He had a real deep dedication, and that was what appealed to me. Well, then there's some other fellows, you know, a couple of them tied for second place and some more tied for third place, but I was just looking, you know, not touching, just looking. And the end of the year at camp meeting, I saw Bob, this tall, thin blonde, with another girl, and she was a cute little doll with black hair and big brown eyes. And, oh, she was so cute. And I was so jealous, I almost died. And I had no reason to be, because he hadn't paid any attention to me. So I had a prayer meeting, because this was a crisis time, and we always pray when we hit crises. And so I dedicated everything to the Lord. I said, Lord, I know I shouldn't even be looking at that young man because he doesn't have a call to China. He's in the home missions band. And I do, so I must be single-minded. And if you want me to go to China as an old maid missionary, that's fine by me. I'll accept it as your will. If you want me to go as a married lady, then you'll have to provide the man and you have to do the picking because I'm not going to go looking. And I didn't. I really was single-minded about it. Just leaving it up to the Lord. Because, well, there weren't any guys available anyway that calls to China, so there was no use looking around. Well, some time went by, and we were seniors. It was March the 2nd, and I came out of the school office, not expecting this day to be any different than any other, and there was this tall, thin blonde standing there. He said, hi. I said, hi. And then in those days, we didn't stop and talk to the fellows in the hall. We had a rule that if you talked to the fellows, you had to keep moving. You know, you had to keep walking. Now, to this day, I can't imagine what that ruling was about, because at this stage of the game, all I can think of is that you could keep walking to the back room. But being a good, dedicated student, I started to move on, and he sort of stood in my way like he was going to say something, but he didn't. So then, being a woman and getting nervous, I started talking. So I said, how's Genevieve? He said, I don't know. And I hadn't seen her for a year because she'd graduated the year before. I said, you don't know? He says, no. And then he narrowed his eyes down and lowered his voice and said, Genevieve doesn't share my call to China. I was the first one to hear the news. And a whole new world opened up for me. I could see all kinds of possibilities I hadn't seen before. Well, that was March. We graduated the end of May, and on graduation night, we were engaged. We were married in September, and we left for Peking, China in January. And I've always been glad that the Lord did the picking for me, because he really knew what he was doing. We had a fabulous marriage. Well, we were in China now, studying the language. I loved it. To this day, I love the Chinese language. It's the most fascinating language in the whole world. It's very old, you know. 4,500 years ago, China had writing. And it's a picture language. And so if you reduce those hand scratches to the pictures that they originally were, it's a picture language, and it's so fascinating. But America feared war with Japan the end of 1940. And although we were in occupied China, occupied by the Japanese, they kept requesting that all of us American citizens leave. After the 7th or 8th notice, we did, a lot of us left. Probably somewhere between 80 and 100 of us. Young people, mostly missionaries of all different denominations, left Peking, took Chinese teachers and the principal's wife, went to the Philippine Islands and set up a branch language school 150 miles north of Manila, up in Baguio, 5,000 feet above sea level, and studied another year. And my husband and I on Saturdays taught in the Bible school for the Filipinos. Well, we expected always to get back to China whenever this thing blew over, but you remember how it did not blow over, it blew up. And one morning early in December, we turned on the radio after we awakened before we went to school, as we always did, and heard the news that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Well, now that was a pretty big shock for us too, so far away. We went to school and the school was all in a dither. And we thought, well, my husband said, never mind. The United States has an Air Force here in the Philippines. We have bases all over. We have a naval base. We have an army here, and the Filipinos have an army. There would be no problems. We can go and help Pearl Harbor. A couple hours after school began, I was on my way home to go to the army base, Camp John Hay. I was expecting our first baby, so I was going out to see the American Army doctor. As I was walking along this bright sunny morning, about 12 or 14 airplanes came over, great big silver planes with no markings on them. I thought, isn't that great? That must be the American Air Force out protecting the Philippines. Well, it was only seconds later till the bombs began to fall on Camp John Hay, where I had been headed for, because I didn't go then. Well, the school was dismissed because the bombings kept up day after day, and we moved out of the town where they had been bombing and strafing out to the edge of the city where our senior missionaries lived, and lived in their garage. Finally, it seemed to be for sure that there was no way to get off of the islands for the American community. There were 500 of us up here in Baguio. There were a lot more down Manila. So the American community decided there was no way, because the Japanese had bombed all the American airplanes on the fields, all the ships in the harbor, and it was a mess. So escape was just out of the question. We packed our bags finally after the Japanese landed in the lowlands, knowing that they eventually would get to the mountain. And we interned ourselves in a boarding school, Brent School. Each family took a room in one of the dormitories, and we just camped for the next few weeks. Dug air raid shelters, sat in air raid shelters. Christmas Day, we opened a can of pork and beans and ate it cold, and just waited, not knowing for what for sure. Finally, 2 days after Christmas, we heard the loud banzai, banzai, of hundreds of voices, it seemed like to us, shouting banzai, ringing across the mountaintop. And we figured out it must be the army arriving, and the Japanese civilians who had been working in the American gold mines were welcoming their conquering country. They came to our school about 5 o'clock that night and asked for the keys to all the automobiles, and of course they drove those off. They said, now go to bed. We'll see you in the morning and talk things over. Bob and I weren't so sure about this see you in the morning bit, so we went to bed fully clothed, and we were very thankful later that we did, because just before midnight, they descended on every room in every dormitory. And it's a very fearsome thing, let me tell you, to wake up and see a foreign soldier at your door and his gun pointed at you and his bayonet drawn. What's he saying? Is it English? Is it Japanese? What does he want? We didn't know. Well, he motioned. We got out of bed. We started to take our coats, and he wouldn't let us take anything. and ordered us out the door. He took what he wanted of our things and rushed us downstairs after he searched us. And every person was being searched and herded downstairs. And when all of our dormitory were out, they marched us over to the center square. In the center square, the Japanese army had their machine guns set up. We had heard lots about mass executions when they took China, and so we thought perhaps this was to be our fate. But it was not at that moment, although later, just before the Americans came in, 3 years and 3 months later, there was an execution date set for us for a mass execution on February the 8th, and the Americans came in on February the 5th. But at this time, they did not mow us down. So they lined us up, women in one line, men in another line, and children in a third line. And if your toddler was 13, 14 months old and can walk, it had to go in the children's line. And there were about 85 children. And then they gave us a long lecture. It lasted over an hour. It filled us with plenty of fear, you know, telling us what we'd have to do and what they intended to do with us. And they were going to mow us down if we did anything that was not to their liking. And then they inferred that we would be separated, we wouldn't see our husbands again, and the children probably would be taken away from us and put in separate places. And then when we were good and afraid, they marched the children off, and the bravest little kids I've ever seen, not one of them cried for its mother, and not one mother bolted for her child either. And then they marched us women off a different direction. Well, we ended up in the same room with the children. It was a second-story classroom. And it's cold in the Philippines, the end of December, that far above sea level. It was like 45, 48 degrees. And it was just a wooden floor, an unheated room. And of course, we'd just been through a scary experience, and we were chilly anyway. But most of the women and children were in their night clothes. And I was thankful that I at least had my clothes on. And so those of us that did not have any babes in arms took the extras of the mothers who had three and four and cuddled them up till morning. The Japanese said, sit down. Be comfortable and don't catch cold, and we'll see you in the morning and give you breakfast. Well, in the morning there was no breakfast. The guards were not in the room, but they were right outside down below. We did not know what had happened to our husbands. Sometime before noon, one of the men folks, and they'd been in the same building all night, was poking around, and they found us. And gradually, you know, we all got together. And oh, what a relief to know that we were at last together with the men folks. It really was a big relief. Well, then, good American fashion, we elected a committee and a chairman, because, you know, we can't operate without committees. And we sent the chairman of the committee to see the Japanese and asked permission for the children, for the fathers of the children, to go to the dorms and get clothes for the children and blankets, because it would be dark in a few hours and it was cold. And so the Japanese are compassionate for children. They gave permission. The fathers went a few at a time. Then the expectant fathers got to go. And so Bob went back and got our number one suitcase. We'd had them labeled in case we could only take one for some time. And then a warm wool blanket for each of us and a warm coat for each of us. And then since I was expecting, he thought I needed special care. And he lugged back a single mattress too. He could only take one load, but he lugged as much as he could. Just about dark, and it gets dark early in the Philippines because it's close to the equator. We were all back together. Most every man had gotten over to the dorms and had gotten something. And so we were all settling down for the night thinking, well, we're still hungry, but at least we're together. And they came storming in and said, the women and children are being moved to a new destination, and so divide your things. Well, they moved us all right, went down the stairs and just across the square, that was all, into another building. This was the dining room. Some of us slept on the floor and some of us slept on the tables, and I think I can tell you what all of us did, at least I did. We cried ourselves to sleep, but nothing loud, but you could hear noses being blown. And we were crying from sheer exhaustion of the day. In the morning, things always look better in the morning, we looked out and saw that our husbands were there, and we felt better. Before noon, the Japanese were petitioned that our people could go into the kitchen and open up the canned goods and feed the people. So they finally gave permission, and they had a long table set up, and the plates were laid out. I can just see them now. Half a slice of bread for every person with a tablespoonful of stew on top. And I was about 40th in line. And just as the people were ready to take the food in their hands, the guards came in with their bayonets drawn, said, leave the food, get out to the tennis courts. And they lined us up again, women, men, children, and they added a fourth line, pregnant women, old people, and cripples. And being of a pessimistic turn of mind, I thought, wonder what they're going to do with us. They surely wouldn't need all of us in wartime. Well, they said, we'll give you 20 minutes, and you'll have to be prepared with your own bundles. Send the children with their bundles. You're all being walked to a new destination. It'll take you a couple hours to get there, or longer, and the children will be sent to one camp, the women and teenage girls to a R&R camp for the soldiers' benefit, Japanese soldiers, and the men will be sent to a work camp, and they inferred that we would not see each other again. So they said, be sure the children have their own clothes. So all those little kids were marched off in 20 minutes with their own little bundles, and not one of them cried, and not one mother did either. Those were a brave bunch of people. And then they waited half an hour and marched off the women, waited another half hour and marched off the men. And I know, because I was there till last. Then they brought trucks like they said they would and put us in the trucks. And 3.5 hours later, we all ended up in the same big barracks on Camp John Hay. And it was wall-to-wall people. As you came in, you sat down, that was your spot. There were no aisles. I came in last, toward the last, and so I was way over there. My husband was somewhere in the middle. And men, women, children, just one big conglomeration. And then when it got dark, which was shortly after we arrived, we just laid down and curled around one another. And then that night at 10 o'clock, the Japanese shut off the water supply. That meant that the flush toilets could not be flushed, but of course 500 people had to use them anyway. And they said, in the morning you can dig latrines. Well, in the morning the men started to dig latrines, and they asked for volunteers then to clean out the toilets that had been used all night. So my husband and a Presbyterian missionary who's in Taiwan now cleaned out the toilets so they could be flushed if the water ever came back on again. The young missionaries had decided that they would do more than their share of all the dirty work that nobody else would want to do to uphold their testimony for Christ. So for the next 4 days then, we had 2 cups of water a day, one in the morning, one at night, nothing to wash our hands with. But the Japanese then, when they wanted to brush their teeth, turned on the fire hydrant outside the barbed wire fence. I had carried Bobby that length of time. My health wasn't really that good because already I was having symptoms of beriberi, vitamin B deficiency, before he was even born. But they found a bottle of vitamin B, and so I lost the 12 pounds of water that I had been gaining as soon as they gave me the vitamin B. So by the time Bobby was born, I was feeling better. And then on that diet, I was able to nurse him for 17 months. And that was a miracle. Our diet consisted mainly of a small bowl of rice cooked kind of sloppy for breakfast. Now I know when I say rice, you're thinking of MJB or golden grain. Well, it was nothing like that, let me assure you. It was the sweepings from the warehouse, and this would be full of dirt and sticks and stones and cockroach parts and rat dirt and rat urine and all kinds of garbage. And so we spread it out on large tables, and the women all had details, spent hours and hours and hours every single day trying to get enough good rice for 500 people. So that was breakfast. Lunch was a white radish cut in half. Supper was another small bowl of rice, and they brought in 15 pounds of meat for 500 people. So all our cooks could do with that would be to make a gravy to put on top of the rice. And then our main vegetable is sweet potato tops. Sometimes we'd have cucumbers boiled, and sometimes chayotes or some other native vegetable in season. But that was our main source of food. Once in a while we'd get a small banana. My husband probably gave me the most sacrificial gift of his life on my first birthday in camp, when he saved me his banana. He had been losing 10 pounds a week on that diet to begin with, and he saved his banana for me, which was probably his most costly gift. Well, our baby was born healthy, like I say, and the Lord kept him healthy, which was a miracle. There were 2 babies that were able to have mother's milk for 17 months. The rest of them were nursed varying intervals, and those whose mothers could not nurse them were in the worst condition of all. Dysentery broke out in camp right at the beginning and was with us all the time. The Japanese provided 8 ounces of milk for a baby, but only half of it was formula. The other half was water. They said they can get by on 4 ounces and you can fill them up on water. And so those babies were malnourished. Every time they caught dysentery and went to the camp hospital, which was a house that we set aside for our hospital, they were fed on rice water, which didn't help their malnutrition one little bit until that they were able to digest the regular affair again. So it was a very tragic situation to see those babies crying and hear them crying and see the mother's distress. But for no reason except God's mercy, Bobby was well and strong. And when we got home, the doctor here in the United States said he couldn't believe that our Bobby was that well. But that was just God's gracious provision. I can't tell you the whole story because it takes so long, but to come back to the very end, the Japanese moved our camp just, well, the end of December, and the Americans came in the 1st of February. And they moved us to Manila, and that was a trying time. We were excited about it, though, because they said they were going to put us on ships. And, of course, in our mind, that meant come home to the United States. But that wasn't what they had in mind. They took us to Old Bilibid Prison down in Manila, which was the staging area from which they were sending the American military prisoners of war to Japan on their empty ships. And many, many hundreds of our American soldier boys lost their lives on the trip to Japan because the American Air Force was back toward the end of the war, softening up the shipping lanes for capture. And they did not know, of course, that the ships were full of American soldiers being taken to Japan. But that evidently was to have been our fate. The first group came down after midnight. They arrived in Manila, something like 2 o'clock in the morning, in a blackout. It took 2 days to move our camp, and our name is at the end of the list, so we came on the second group. But the first group arrived in a blackout, and the Japanese said, now, this is the hospital area for this big prison, and just lie down. There are beds and mattresses. Make yourselves at home. You're tired. And so they did, but they soon found out the beds were crawling with bed bugs. And of course, it became light in a few hours, and the doctors were horrified when they saw that all the mattresses were covered with human filth, as were the floors. Because this was the hospital section, yes, but these American soldiers had been left to die unattended. They had no nursing care except what each could offer to the other. And so they just lay there until they died. And their graves were around the outside of our building, which when it rained while we were there, the graves were so shallow they floated. And then that was running into our water supply. So it was a tragic situation, really. But the people, by the time we got there 24 hours later, had cleaned up the place. They'd burned all the beds and all the mattresses, and we had nice, clean cement, wet floors to sleep on. But at least we didn't see what they had seen. Then it was just a few weeks later then, till one evening about 5 o'clock, someone on the second story said, look, American airplanes. Well, we had seen some flying very high for the last 3 months. But these were flying low, and they were small planes, not large ones. So, of course, we all rushed upstairs, but it wasn't long until we all had to rush downstairs and lie flat on the floor because it was the American advance force. MacArthur heard that we were being executed, and Camp Santa Tomas was just about 6 blocks from us, and that was the camp that he knew was there. They didn't really know we were there. They found that out later. But they knew that this large camp of thousands of people were going to be executed. So MacArthur sent a force from Lingayen Gulf, 800 men on trucks. And they went right down straight through Luzon, that's the island's name, right down to Manila. The Japanese, 20,000 to 40,000 of them, thought that this was a large landing. They did not know it was so small. And so they retreated to the south of the river which divides Manila and holed up in the walled city, the old Spanish fort. But the fighting, of course, broke out before they actually really got clear across. And then the Japanese set fire to the city on the north, all along the north bank. And with the Americans coming in and the ammunition dumps going off and this fire raging up to our gates, it was really an exciting time in our lives. The soldiers got off their trucks and they took us out that first night north of the city until they could get the fire out because it was burning the city very rapidly. It was right up to our gates when they put us on their trucks and took us out. But they had to bring us back because the war was still being fought for Manila. It had not been decided by any means. So they brought us back to our prison, and those walls kept us safe. And none of us in our camp were hurt, although shrapnel, great big hunks of it, were flying through the buildings, and bombs were dropping on the walls. And, well, for 3 weeks, we sat on the front lines. I didn't have a gun, couldn't participate, but I know what it is to be on the front lines of a battle. And the smell after 3 weeks of dead bodies was really out of this world, different than anything I've ever smelled before. Well, as soon as the American government could, they flew us out, and we came home to the United States. Then, on the first ships that were available, 16 months later, we went back to China. By this time, we had another little boy, so we had two. We took the baby back with us. He learned to walk on the ship. He was one of those live wires, so he really kept me busy. We couldn't get into Peking, so we went to Hankou, which is in central China, about 500, 600 miles up the Yangtze River. And such a big river. I've never seen such a large river in my life. To take the ferry boat across the river, it took 45 minutes. River. It was a large, large river that far upstream. And we opened up a chapel. Now, our Chinese language was just beginners. We had had 2 years of language study, but 2 years in Chinese is just a good beginning. 2 years in Spanish, and you can be quite fluent, I understand, but it takes 4 years in Chinese. So we had our 2 years of language study, and we were going to use it because here we were. And I just think it points out how extravagant God is. He sent us out right before the war broke to learn the language, and then he got us back there right at the end of the war. And China had never been so open in all of its history as it was right after the war. The people just crowded this little chapel night and day asking, who is Jesus? Tell us about Jesus. And they were being converted, they were burning their gods, they were being baptized in water. It was a marvelous, marvelous time. And our family suffered. It seems like there's always such a high price to pay. But our boys took pneumonia. It was cold there in the winter, and the Chinese fuel was coal balls mixed with clay, and this clay just didn't burn. So we didn't have heat that was adequate, and the boys went into pneumonia. And we came very close to losing both of them. And this one night, the baby was 13 months old, and he had been sick for several days, and we had gotten the best medication that we could for him. But he evidently was dying because his breathing, I'd been holding him for hours and hours, and he was sort of unconscious. And then his breathing changed, and I called Bob in the middle of the night, and he was all blue. And then so Bob and I prayed, and I said, honey, what does the Lord say to you? He said, well, he tells me that this illness is going to be no more serious than a cold. So we just sat down then and waited. Although he was struggling for breath, we waited and we waited. In about 15, 20 minutes, his breathing changed. He turned pink. And by mid-morning, he was up bouncing around in his crib. But the Chinese were so open to the gospel that it wasn't long before we had to segregate everybody. We had boys' church in the morning at 9 because we just couldn't get everybody in the building. And they filled the place. We had baptized Christians church at 11 o'clock, and we couldn't let in anybody else. And then in the afternoon we had the girls' church, and they doubly packed the place because they each carry a brother and a sister. And then every night of the week was for the unsaved, and they just packed the place out. But it only lasted 2 years, two short years, and the communists were gradually coming from the north, and so we had to leave. We left it. By that time we had a Chinese pastor who had us to cross, totally surprised by this joy that came into my heart. And I thought, hey, maybe this stump is going to put out an old pussy willow or something. It looks like a sprout is beginning to sprout. And this is great. And for the first time, I was glad to be alive. Well, 13 months went by. I was still working, still doing the same things. And the shop had become my mission field. I was praying for all the fellows and the girls. And that was my mission field. And one day I saw somebody off to Africa, a young couple at the airport, and I hit a crisis time. I cried all evening. I went to bed and I woke up in the morning, and my son said, who's visiting me from Alaska, he said, how was your day, Mom? I said, oh, just terrible. And I began to cry, and I cried and I cried. So I thought, there's no use going to Sunday school, there's no use going anywhere, I'm all dressed to go, but I'm going to sit right here on the floor until the Lord and I have this out. I've hit another crisis time, and the Lord and I are going to have this out. So I sat down on the floor. And I'd been reading in Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and Paul had been writing to the Corinthians, and he said, every one of you has a gift. Some of you are married. Some of you are single. Some of you are widows. Some of you are widows. Some of you are divorced. And some of you are slaves. But if you are free, don't try to get married. If you're married, don't try to get free. If you're a slave, don't try to get free. But wherever you are, let God take that circumstance right where you are and make something beautiful out of it. So I said, Lord, I thank you for the gift of being a wife. I really enjoyed it, and I had it good, and I knew I'd had it good. And that was one reason I had missed it so much. So I said, I thank you, Lord. And I think you ladies will know how good I had it if I tell you this. About 6 years before he died, I had one of those ladies' magazines where you get your husband's faults and you put them down in one line, you know. And then you get his good points and you write them down in the other line. And then they're supposed to cancel each other off, you know, or balance or something. So I thought, oh, there must be something I can put in that bad line. And I thought and I thought and I thought. Finally, 3 or 4 days later, I thought of one thing I could put in that bad list. Sometimes he put his drinking glass on the left-hand side of the sink. Now you know I had it good, don't you? And I thanked the Lord for that experience, and I thanked him for the privilege of living with a man of God like I had, and I was grateful, and I know I'll have to give an account for that period of my life someday. I thanked him then for the gift of motherhood. I loved being a mother. I really did. I liked 2 o'clock feedings. I had the baby all to myself. It was quiet and dark. I liked it. I liked being a mother. So I thank him for that experience, and I know I'll have to give an account for that period of my life. And then I said, now, Lord, you've given me another gift, the gift of widowhood, and I don't like it. I've tried it for 13 months, and I don't like it. I can't find one good thing about it, but I've got it. And how am I going to present this to you as a gift? It's not beautiful. It's ugly in my eyes. It's too heavy to carry on my back. It's too sharp to clutch to me, but I've got it. I don't know if it's going to last 6 more weeks, 6 more months, 6 more years, or 30 years. Who knows how long I will live. And I've got it, the gift of widowhood. How can I fix this up? I can't do it, Lord. I can't do it. What'll I do with it? And yet I've got to present this someday to you as my gift. Well, he let me go on, and then he let me know. He didn't ever scold me or chide me, and I appreciate that about this good shepherd. He's so gentle. He let me know that I could offer it back to him. Well, now that's not much of a gift. Loneliness, sorrow, bitterness. Yes, I had some bitterness. I wasn't so mad at God for taking Bob, but I was peeved at him for leaving me behind. But that wasn't the worst part of my bitterness. In the church, you know, when you live with people closely, like you do as pastor, his wife, or the people, there were a few people, 3 of them to be exact, who criticized my husband. Now, it does never help to criticize your pastor, and it can kill his wife. And so, if Bob had lived, this would just been like hundreds of other things that I'd heard in my lifetime. But since he had died, I held bitterness against these people for saying these things. And I said, Lord, I can't forgive them. I can't forget what they've said. And I kept, you know, just kept reviewing it all the time until I had bitterness in my heart. And I said, Lord, my house is burned down, and you promised beauty for ashes. Now, ashes are easy to wash away with a hose or with a bulldozer or with a broom, but you can't wash away the refrigerator and the stove. They don't melt down into very good ashes. And so I had some bitter lumps. And so I sat there on the floor and I said, Lord, will you take all away? I've tried so hard over these last months. Will you do what I can't do? And he did. He took it all away. Took all the lumps out and left just ashes. And he promised to make beauty out of ashes, and I know he will. So I presented it to him, this gift of widowhood. Now, like I said, that's not much of a gift. But then the boys' lunch wasn't much of a gift either. The disciple says, what's this among so many? But I presented it to him and asked him to transform it into something beautiful for his glory. A few days went by, and an elderly missionary who's retired was taking another trip back to the Orient. She said, "Would you like to go with me on a teaching tour to Australia and Indonesia and the Orient?" I said, "Oh, I would love to. I would love to. I think I can leave my job and my house for a few months and go with you." So I was thinking about it, praying about it. I sent a word to Springfield, our headquarters, and talked to them about it. And they wrote back after a few weeks and said, "If you want to go to the foreign fields, we have three countries that could use you right away. So you better come back to Springfield and talk to us." So I went back to Springfield, and the three countries they had offered were Manila and the Philippines, which held for me memories of what had been, Johannesburg, South Africa, which held memories of what might have been, and the other was Brussels. I wasn't qualified for that position. So that night, before I met with all these brethren in this table all by myself, I walked up and down this football-sized lawn, and I prayed for well over an hour, I'm sure, as I walked up and down. I said, "Lord, I have two unfulfilled desires, and I don't know which one of these to choose if these men leave it up to me." I said, "I've always wanted to do something for American servicemen since they liberated us from the Philippines. Some 10,000 of them gave their lives that we might be liberated. I've always wanted to be a house mother or something. And then my other one is the Chinese language and the Chinese people. I know it's been 28 years since I've been back to China and used the language, but I think it's there in my head someplace. If it could be brought out again, I think it's possible. But what about it, Lord? Is this another unfulfilled desire? But I present these two to you, and whatever you choose, that will be fine." So I met the next day then with this committee, and we talked over each of these three things that they had suggested, and none of them seemed quite right to me. So I said, "Is there anything else?" And the secretary for the Far East said, "Yes." He said, "In Taiwan, we need someone to work in the office for the American servicemen's headquarters office." And we set up retreats for the American servicemen all over the Far East. And the other half the job, he said, is working with a correspondence school. The Chinese college students take the correspondence course because they want to know about Christianity and that don't want to go to a church. And then when they get a nucleus, they have Bible clubs, and I'd be teaching the Chinese students the Bible. And it was all laid out there before me. Everything was just there. So there was no question but what God was in it. So I'm going back to Taiwan. I'm supposed to leave July 5th, stopping in the Marshall Islands on my way to speak for a ladies' retreat for the Marshallese women, the Micronesian women. And I'm looking forward to that. And then on to Taiwan. And I just hope someday to get back into mainland China. This fall, while I was still working in the appliance shop, I went to the university and wanted to review my Chinese, and I thought, well, I'd have to start at the beginning, but that was too slow, so I jumped into the second year, and I paddled hard. I really had to work hard at it to catch up with the kids, because they'd only been out of school a few weeks, but I did, and it was a very rewarding experience, and the reading came back very quickly. Now, the speaking part, I'm going to have to wait, I think, till I hear it, to get it really to come back again. But God is able, and I found a definition for faith. It's taken from some words written on an underground tunnel in Germany. "I believe in the sun," this man wrote, he was underground, "even when it isn't shining. I believe in love, even when there's no one there. And I believe in God. I believe in God, even when he is silent." And sometimes you will come to experiences in your life where God is silent and he doesn't give any explanations, and you don't know why you are in the circumstance that you're in. And you'll find yourself up to a Red Sea experience. And the psalmist said in Psalm 77 that God led them on a path, and the pathway led through the Red Sea. But the pathway, no one knew was there. Well, it was covered up by the Red Sea. But in the proper time, God rolled the sea back, and the path was there. And you'll have that experience many times. You'll come up to the edge, and you'll see no way on past out of this experience that you're in. Now, I'm sure in a group this size that there's someone here today that's in the middle of an experience that you would just love to get out of if you could. You'd like to run away from it if you could. You'd give anything to get out of it, but God has left you in it. And I would just like to leave this message with you. Turn it over to him And in that situation, let him pour in his grace and his love and